everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. It is Friday, and that means it's Godzilla's arch nemesis, Kong. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I write for Slash Film, and I don't have a cute nickname. I needn't one, but you can call me whatever you like, I guess.
And this is the podcast where we review every Godzilla and Godzilla-adjacent movie. And we recently hit another big era in the tale of Godzilla. It is the legendary MonsterVerse.
And that's right.
Unlike a lot of the other eras of Godzilla, there's a lot of back and forth. Because we're not just in the legendary MonsterVerse. Toho is still making movies. Netflix is going to be making some animated movies. We're going to be jumping back and forth. But this is officially the second film in the legendary MonsterVerse. It is a podcast about Kong, Skull Island.
And everything's fractured, man. Everything just sort of flew apart there at the end of the Millennium Era. Everything seemed like to be so direct. Such a strong forward track. And now we're in this weird bouncing around, rebooting continuities. It's a little frustrating. But this is the second film in the MonsterVerse, like you said. And if you go back two episodes, that's when we talked about the first film in the MonsterVerse universe. Last week was Shin Godzilla. Shin Godzilla, which we both really loved. We were very positive on that one.
Great movie.
But we weren't so positive on Gareth Edwards' American Godzilla film. We understood that it was more about its sort of style than about its story, and it wasn't really about much of anything. It was just, trying to find interesting filmic ways to tell a Godzilla story without really having anything to say with Godzilla.
And I think I appreciated that more than you did. I actually thought I thought some of the ways that they had conceived to film a Godzilla movie in the modern visual effects era were often quite neat. And a lot of them were kind of worth the price of admission on their own. But wow, just not a well-written movie, just in general.
Bad script, not very focused, and frustratingly kept the monsters obfuscated. Kong Skull Island is constructed more like a classic King Kong movie, so we're not going to see the monster for a lot. The first part of the movie is people getting to Skull Island, and that's something that's happened in all the Godzilla film, or excuse me, all the King Kong movies we've had since the 30s.
Although, to be fair, we get to Kong 30 minutes into this film. That's actually pretty good. Can you compare it to, like, the Peter Jackson movie, which I like more than most? It takes them, like, an hour to get to Kong in that movie. It's kind of ridiculous. Like,
90 minutes and they finally get to the island.
And I like it. I actually think the director's cut of that movie, which is longer but better paced, works. I think that version of the movie works really, really well. But, what was the name of that band? Some band did a song where the chorus was all about the Peter Jackson King Kong, and the chorus was, "Get to the fucking monkey! Get to the fucking monkey!" Like, it's just, get on with it!
Sounds like Tenacious D.
No, it wasn't them. Well, I'll look him up, because that was a funny bit. I'll give him that.
We're back to sort of a classic King Kong structure, and we haven't had a lot of chance to talk about King Kong outside of the Godzilla context, because there's no Godzilla in this film other than, like, a post-credits cameo.
And even that's just a roar and, like, some cave paintings. The band, by the way, is called Tripod.
Tripod,
if you want to listen to that song, you can listen to it. It's by Tripod. It came out in, I think, 2006.
All right.
Yeah.
But King Kong, we've sort of only mentioned in passing, and so maybe we should, like, take a minute to go over King Kong just very briefly, because there's actually a lot to get through with King Kong. But
it's been a while since we've really had to get into King Kong, because they had the crossover in the 1960s, and then one sequel to that, and then we haven't covered any of the other Kong movies. The first King Kong is a milestone in visual effects. It didn't invent stop motion, but it was a huge stop motion visual effects Bonanza. And if anyone is unfamiliar with the concept of stop motion, the idea is this. Film, especially back in the old days when it was a tangible film strip, consists of a series of individual frames. And usually when you record something live action, you're recording them at speed. You're recording 24 frames per second as the seconds go by. But if you wanted to, it's a time-consuming process, you can just film one frame at a time. And so you take an object, in this case like a puppet of a monkey, or an ape, I guess, technically.
Monkeys have tails, apes do not.
Technically different. But you take it, this case, it's a puppet, essentially. And you film one frame, and then you move it ever so slightly. And then you film another frame, and then you move it ever so slightly, and then you move another frame. And if you do that enough, you create the illusion of fluid or somewhat fluid movement.
Yeah. And
for many years, this was used as visual effects or as for like short animated movies. And in more recent decades, there have been more and more stop motion full feature films.
Yeah. And stop motion has a really cool look to it. I've always liked the way stop motion looks, especially when clay is used as a medium a lot in stop motion animation, or like just usually they make these little sort of skeletons or maquettes that are poseable, so they can kind of bend them as the animators can bend them as they go.
Yeah.
And often if it's like furry or clay, you can see like
fingerprints,
the fur rumpling, or you can see fingerprints on them. And that adds a little bit of texture and a little of life to stop motion. So you watch King Kong, there's actually a little bit of, it's not totally slick. There's a little bit of this jerkiness, a little bit of error in it that I think makes it look a lot more dynamic and interesting.
Well, I think the visual effect, the effect of the visual style of stop motion, I think it connects on a much more visceral way, because unlike hand-drawn animation or even most CG animation, even the good stuff, they're actually filming something in physical space.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
our
they
eyes
have to light and it and build a miniature set. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And our eyes are like, and again, sometimes it's very, very good, but a lot of the time our eyes can tell when something is a visual effect, when something's painted on. And we've been trained to accept it, but we don't believe that it's real. But when you look at the skeletons in Jason and the Argonauts, at the end of that movie, the bad guys raise an army of skeletons with swords and shields, and they fight the Jason and all the heroes. They look like magic skeletons. That's what they look like. And I think a lot of the better stop-motion animated movies tend to use stop-motion to bring to life creatures that are a little unreal. But the fact that they were able to be filmed physically in front of a camera gives them this... It's not an uncanny valley effect. It's like almost at the uncanny valley, you know? But it's just below the tip. Just below the edge of the... like one step further and it would be in the uncanny valley. And if you look at the original King Kong, this glorious black and white movie, a fantastic stop-motion filmmaker named Willis O'Brien did the visual effects... not only are there there's a lot of different monsters. There's King Kong. There's like a T-Rex or an Allosaurus. There's a Stegosaurus. There's wonderful creatures. But even though it's a time-consuming process, Willis O'Brien made sure to add little incidental moments that made it feel like we did just capture a private moment with King Kong. Like after he like kills a dinosaur, he like plays with its jaw a little bit, like, oh, interesting, you know. and that little extra effort of detail, I think, really matters. But I think on top of that, it's worth noting that King Kong is a really interesting movie beyond the visual effects. If you've ever seen it, it's a story of a group of filmmakers who are traveling to a mysterious island they've only heard of called Skull Island. And they've brought a movie star with them, played by the luminous Fay Wray. And they're going to basically exploit it. They're going to exploit the land. They're going to exploit the animals. They're going to exploit the indigenous people. And it's worth noting that the filmmakers who made King Kong were kind of known for doing that. These kinds of safari pictures were very common, and they were huge blockbusters. And this is basically a movie about movie making, about going to a real place and filmmakers basically destroying it, which is all, is weirdly self-aware, actually.
It's weirdly self-aware, but at the same time, I guess King Kong is a little bit of a criticism of itself, because the filmmakers were named Marion C. Cooper and Ernest B. Schoedsack. And yeah, they were documentarians. They would go to faraway places and make these documentary films about, quote, exotic places. And exotic just means far away from the United States. Mm-hmm. And yeah, these filmmakers were just taking on a very commonly colonialist mindset, something that had been going on for centuries of going to a faraway place and just sort of taking advantage of it as you saw fit, because that was your goal and your job as a colonialist. You were, you gave yourself the moral right to just take whatever you wanted to and raise the land and exploit whatever you needed to.
And a lot of these movies feature like horrible things happening, like the on-camera deaths of like animals that hunters are hunting. It's really disturbing.
Yeah, the idea of being a hunter and killing an animal was seen as something kind of cool and heroic. So that was actually depicted on camera. And indeed, in a lot of these early films, there's real animal death on camera. They would actually shoot an animal to show people how cool it was, and audiences would presumably go, "Oof, how scary that is."
They
would
be shocked or horrified.
Oh my goodness, that rhinoceros was charging. Thank goodness they shot and killed it. Yeah. And they would depict that on camera.
And weirdly enough, King Kong, this other movie that they made, turns the animal that they're exploiting into a tragic figure.
Yeah, yeah. And the end of the movie, very famous, yeah, and I don't need to... There's no spoilers with King Kong. It's one of the most famous movies of all time. King Kong climbs the Empire State Building, gets shot by biplanes, falls to his death.
Yeah.
And somebody steps in and says, in this really mawkish way, I think it's one of the most awkward endings in film history, just says, no, it was beauty killed the beast. And because Fay Wray, and like King Kong was very enamored of Fay Wray, and Fay Wray was like, had a little bit of a connection with this gigantic ape.
And it was the filmmaker character, and he's basically saying, not my fault.
Yeah, it was beauty killed the beast. And he's trying to... I always saw that as sort of the filmmaker trying to wrap it up without understanding what has happened here. Yeah. He is deflecting. He's trying to put an object... Like, he's turning a tragedy into sort of a film story in front of us. Mm. And there's something kind of pathetic about that.
Yeah.
It was beauty killed the beast. No, it was bullets and hate.
If only King Kong hadn't loved, it would still be alive and exploited for our amusement.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you killed that creature.
Yeah.
You kidnapped it. You brought it to the city. Of course it got shot down. That's your fault, asshole.
And that's the damnedest thing. It's like the movie has one level of self-awareness, and in other times, it's just completely... like almost blithely unaware of what it's doing. There's a sequence when they get to Skull Island where the indigenous people do a big musical number, and boy, is that hot takes galore about that. That is not okay.
We do need to talk about how King Kong has been criticized for its racist imagery.
Yep.
The island natives King Kong is hardly the only piece of American media to do this. It's had been going on for a long, long time. Watch any Tarzan movie.
But
this idea of these, like, quote, exotic natives, were these kind of racial stereotypes, these racist caricatures that the filmmakers would put in as a way of communicating to a white American audience that, you know, how strange it is that these, you know, people from faraway lands would behave in such a strange fashion. There are all these racist stereotypes that they're tapping into.
Yeah.
And a lot of modern interpretations of King Kong actually saw King Kong as sort of a symbol for blackness. That King Kong was used as also a racist stereotype. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the relationship between King Kong and Fay Wray has been said by some critics, white and black, as a symbol for an interracial relationship, and how horrible it was that this weird ape-like beast should sort of be coming after our white women, which is something racist people mimic all the time.
Yeah.
It should also be noted that Adolf Hitler was very fond of this movie.
Oh, I didn't know about that. That makes a lot of sense, though. That makes a lot of sense, though. There's a famous scene in Inglourious Basterds where they're playing like a bar game, and one character kind of finds his way. I think it's the Nazi character finds his way into discussing King Kong as an allegory for Africans being abducted and taken in chains to America for the slave trade.
Mm.
And that's not an unreasonable read of the text, actually.
So there's a lot of that is lurking underneath, but I think King Kong was just so viscerally powerful that we keep coming back to the concept, the gigantic ape, and the gigantic ape that rules its own homeland and is kidnapped and brought to the United States. That's the King Kong story.
Basically.
Or taken to Japan, depending on what country the movie was made in.
Yeah.
So, the idea of a gigantic ape has stayed with popular culture ever since then. And thanks to the 1962 film, King Kong versus Godzilla, there's always been a little bit of a rivalry between Japan's most famous monster and the first, you could call it, an American kaiju.
I guess technically that. I don't want to go that far because there were definitely large monster movies in the silent era, although most of the ones that I know about are about like literal dinosaurs. I don't want to go too far about that, but
King Kong might be the first large fantasy creature.
Possibly. But I'm always hesitant to make that kind of like, historical first statement because I'm sure someone could think of an exception, but regardless, he's the iconic one. He's the one that sort of typified that type of monster in media for a long time, and he had a sequel, Son of Kong. There was a very similar movie made in the 1940s called Mighty Joe Young, which would later be remade in the 1990s. Giant apes lingered in the consciousness, and then in the 1950s, American movies. It's weird that we didn't bring back Kong in the 1950s, actually, because giant monster movies were back and they were very de rigueur. There was A Beast in 20,000 Fathoms. There was, I think it was 20 Million Miles to Earth.
Mantis, all that kind of stuff.
The beginning of the end. The giant monsters were very, very popular for a while there. And it's kind of weird that America didn't bring back King Kong at that time, because I think it probably would have made bank. We go into the backstory of the first King Kong versus Godzilla movie in our episode about that earlier in the timeline. But basically, through a weirdly elaborate and complicated backstory for that production, eventually they came up with the idea of King Kong fighting Godzilla, and that's a very strange film. There was a sequel to that called King Kong Escapes. That is somehow an even stranger film. And then there was a remake of King Kong in the 1970s with Jeff Bridges and Charles Grodin. And
Jessica Lange is Jessica the favorite Lange. Character, yeah.
Her name escaped me for a second. I am not a fan of that movie. I find that movie
terminally
dull.
No one
dull.
Is. It was
very dull.
It was widely hailed as quite bad. It did keep King Kong in the popular consciousness. And I remember in the 1980s, Universal Studios Hollywood had a King Kong part of their tram tour.
Oh, you went on that, right?
I have. I went on that a couple of times.
Awesome.
You would take the backlot tour on this long tram, and they'd sort of drive you through. And of course, the joke was, you were going to drive through this tunnel. Oh, no, there's an earthquake. And of course, it was all like animatronic special effects and staged. Mm-hmm. But it was really impressive because you got to see it live in front of you.
Yeah.
And for King Kong, they actually built this like 30-foot tall animatronic. It was a huge robot.
Oh, yeah, very,
and you drive out onto a bridge, and this giant animatronic would look like it was grabbing onto the bridge and shaking it, and the road you were on would kind of tip back and forth a little bit. And it was really scary, and it was really cool. Mm. When the Peter Jackson film came out, they updated it. You had to put on like 3D glasses. It was all on a screen. It wasn't quite as exciting.
Well, you skipped, there was a sequel to that King Kong called King Kong Lives. In 1986,
which nobody
ever talks about. Like, it's just vanished from the consciousness. And I'll be perfectly frank, I've never even seen it.
I keep forgetting to watch it. All of the 70s one. I've only seen parts of the 70s one.
It's not very good. But but when Peter Jackson, this was Peter Jackson's, like, follow-up to The Lord of the Rings. This was like, he had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted, and he wanted to do King
this
Kong.
Was in 2005. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? Bless him. It's your passion project, man. Do whatever you want. And he took this very tightly constructed original film. What is it like? It's less than 80 minutes, I think.
Oh, no, the original King Kong?
Yeah.
It's 100 minutes. It's like feature length.
Is it 100? Well, yeah, I knew it was feature length. Is it really?
Yeah, but Peter Jackson's version was over. Peter Jackson's version was over 3 hours long.
No, you're right. It was an hour and 40 minutes. I'm confusing it with something else, and I apologize. But no. He created this like giant 3 hour epic, and he romanticized not just the romance in Kong, but like every aspect of it. So the idea is that the Fay Wray character, who is now played by Naomi Watts, we meet her as she's just showing up for work. Yeah, you hired me. Here I am. We have to see her struggling in vaudeville. We meet the other characters who are, like, having trouble in the Great Depression finding work. We see her, like, looking hungry. And then we meet the director, and the director's showing off his latest safari footage. And then no one cares. And it's just so much padding. Like, I can appreciate if you just really love the movie and you just want to see more of it, it's there. And at that level, I kind of enjoy that movie. But it's not an efficient film. And what's weird about it is that the thing they absolutely most needed to update, like, hey, you know what movie has parts that really have aged badly? King Kong, right? Okay,
yeah,
so
absolutely.
And then instead of making its portrayal of the indigenous people of Skull Island better, it's at best a lateral move. Like, they're really demonized. Yeah. It's weird. Like, it's a weird choice.
In Kong Skull Island, to finally get around to it,
this
is the second film in the MonsterVerse, but it's a flashback. Godzilla took place in the present. This one takes place in the 1970s.
1974.
And in fact, I saw this when it came out, and I thought it was okay. I didn't think too much of it. I watched it the second time around, and there's actually a lot more going on in this movie than I originally thought. Because this
apologies, 1973. My bad. 1973.
Yeah, it's set in 73, and it's right at the end of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, it took a lot of stylistic cues from Apocalypse Now. There's a lot of these shots of the helicopters. There's a lot of uses of 1970s popular music that they put on the soundtrack. They give it a kind of washed out 70s style photography, so it looks a little bit like it's got a little bit of grit on it, even though, you know, Kong is still a big CGI creation. And the plot involves a character played by Samuel L. Jackson. And we'll get to all of the other characters, because there's a lot of characters in this thing.
I think it's interesting that you're starting with that one, but okay.
Well, I'm starting with Samuel L. Jackson because I think he's the one who's carrying what this movie's really about.
Okay.
And he's the soldier. And he is the one who has pulled out of Vietnam. And he's the one who's been humiliated.
Yeah.
He's America. Yeah. Who has been humiliated by his interference in Vietnam. There was no way to win that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It was a complete quagmire. And yet he's the soldier who was the true believer.
Yeah.
He believed that there was a way to win that war, and there was a way to do it sort of in this noble, we defeated a bad guy kind of a way.
Yeah.
And people even point out to him, didn't you lose this war?
And he says, and no, he says, we abandoned it.
We didn't lose the war, we abandoned it. And that will go to the story later on when he loses one of his soldiers, has to go find the soldier, but really what he wants to do is destroy King Kong. And what really he wants to do is win the Vietnam War by proxy. That's what his story arc is all about.
Yeah.
Which means Kong Skull Island, Kong is Vietnam. The monster is the Vietnam War. And that means this movie's actually about something.
Isn't that kind of nice? It's heavy-handed, it's nice, though, right? Like, it actually, feels. And it's about something that's a little heavy. It's not just about, like, oh, he loved Naomi Watts. Isn't that sad? Like, no. It's actually, like, it's much unlike the Peter Jackson movie, which I just said failed miserably to update the most problematic parts of the original, here they're foregrounding that a little bit. And actually, the treatment of the indigenous people in this movie is, at best, at least, an improvement. But it's all about how fucked up it is that a bunch of American soldiers just run into a country, bomb it indiscriminately, and then when people say, hey, fuck you, they say, oh, well, you're villains. Like, it's again, it's not subtle, but it's it works. It's messed up.
So we have a King Kong movie that is critical of the concepts in King Kong. Villainizes the American military and is ultimately an anti-war picture. In fact, it's specifically an anti-Vietnam picture.
Yeah.
And I really kind of appreciated that by the end of it.
I think this is a very good movie, actually.
Yeah. I really liked some of the characters I really liked. A lot of them are completely disposable, specifically the main two characters. They are just cardboard, dull, dry toast characters. Because we have Tom Hiddleston.
For the sake of efficiency, let's run down the main characters because there's actually quite a lot. I'm actually going to start. I'll get back to Tom Hiddleston in a second because the person driving the story at first is a scientist played by John Goodman. Who is the head of Monarch, which we learned was a part of the government that was formed under Harry Truman. Was it Harry Truman? Hold on, I wrote this down. Where did I find this? It was a whole thing. It was Truman. Truman formed Monarch, and it turns out that, as we learn in Godzilla, all of the bombings, the nuclear testing in the 1950s was all just a cover for trying to kill giant monsters that they had found. John Goodman is convinced that there is a giant monster ecosystem somewhere in the Pacific, and now that they have only just recently invented satellite photography, they have now located Skull Island, which was hidden under like this permanent cloud bank for centuries. So even though it had been kind of spoken of in hushed terms, no one had ever found it before, and he and his assistant, played by Corey Hawkins, who is the person who... like created the Hollow Earth theory, which will be very important to this franchise moving forward. Well, he didn't create it, but he's like his work apparently legitimized it in this universe. They go to Richard Jenkins, just getting a paycheck.
barely in the movie. Scenes. I think he's only in maybe the one scene.
He's in like 3 minutes of the movie tops, and it's just them pitching the plot of the movie. Hey, we got to go to this island. And he's like, why would we do that? And it's like, well, if we finally discovered it, that means the Russians finally discovered it, and you want us to get there first, right? And he's like, I think he actually says, you know what? That almost makes sense, so fine. It's literally just like the screenwriter saying, yeah, that's a good enough justification, right? That can we move on? Because the only important thing is that he says yes, right? So they enlist a security detail of Marines who were just leaving. They were just leaving Vietnam. Like, the day they pitch this to Richard Jenkins is the last day of the Vietnam War. Like, Richard Nixon is actually just saying, sorry.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah.
and we meet a whole bunch of guys, and frankly, even though they're all kind of likable, a lot of them are really nondescript, but there's good actors in there. We got Jason Mitchell, Shea Whigham, who is just always good in everything, and he has a whole bunch of weird lines of dialogue, and he has a really epic, hilarious death, and we'll get to that. And Toby Kebbell, who is actually in many respects most famous for being a motion capture actor, and I kind of assumed that they had cast him kind of like when they had cast like Andy Serkis in Peter Jackson's King Kong, because he also played Kong and might as well give him a live action role.
The motion capture for the ape. Yeah.
Apparently, no. Terry Notary did the motion capture for Godzilla. I think Toby Kebbell might have been consulted
for
on that.
King Kong.
For King Kong. Ugh. He did the motion. Terry Notary did the motion capture for King Kong, and Toby Kebbell, who had done a lot of like motion capture work in like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I think he might have been consulted. I don't know, but I'm looking at it here. Looks like Toby Kebbell did some like facial reference work, so I guess he did kind of play him briefly in a few bits.
Toby Kebbell played an ape in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, the main bad guy. Yeah. Which is a great motion capture performance, by the way.
And I feel like it takes a certain kind of like expressive actor to do that kind of performance. And Toby Kebbell is one of the best.
It's really interesting because Andy Serkis has become kind of the face of mocap, but he's not the only person who's done consistently excellent work in that regard. And I feel like Toby Kebbell is often overlooked. in that field.
Yeah.
But Terry Notary does a lot of good work too, so kudos to everyone involved. But anyway, they enlist these Marines, and they were just about to go home, and they were really excited to go home, and they're pissed off. Joining them are a couple other scientists who were going anyway. They're all fodder. They'll all die. They have nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there was a Chinese superstar.
Yeah.
Who is the actress? Jing Tian.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what I understand, she's a big deal in her native China, but evidently she was cast. They were hoping to have her be like this major player, and then they just kind of wrote her out of the story.
Yeah, she's barely there.
So yeah, okay, you're another character. You're just on the side.
Yeah. But the other two main characters who are introduced to are Tom Hiddleston, who plays an expert like jungle tracker, just in case everything goes haywire, we might need one of those, and wouldn't you know? And then Brie Larson plays a war photographer.
War photographer.
She describes herself as an anti-war photographer, which I liked. And you know, the Vietnam War is shutting down, and what's she gonna do? And she finds out about this mysterious mission and thinks there might be something to it. And hey, you know what? Good instincts, because yeah, you're gonna get a lot of good photos. So they all get together and they all take a big boat and they drive over to Skull Island, and then they get there to this island that they know, the only thing they know about it is that it's surrounded by a perpetual storm front. And then the scientists who are all going to get killed say, oh, it's a bit stormy, well, we shouldn't go. And then John Goodman's like, well, I wanna, and they're like, well, we shouldn't. And then John Goodman's like, Samuel L. Jackson, can you cast the deciding vote? And Samuel L. Jackson, who just doesn't want to go home, sends them into the storm.
He needs to keep the war going.
Yeah. Their plan, when they get to the island, is absolutely terrible. Because their plan is, and they're justifying it by saying they're going to drop explosives from helicopters just randomly over the island. Just fuck up a mysterious ecosystem that they know nothing about. Or possibly kill people who might be living there for all they know. Just throw bombs out there. Which, again, is actually pretty in keeping with American policy, but ostensibly they're doing that to set up seismic charges to check for that hollow earth theory of Corey Hawkins, which is immediately proven correct. But what they're really doing is they're dropping off these explosives in order to wake up any giant monsters who might be there. And sure enough, Kong shows up, and there's a great bit. I actually love this bit, because it's the helicopter's all flying over, and they're all super apocalypse now, and you see like the explosions go off in the foliage, and they're like reflected in a guy's aviator glasses. And then a palm tree harpoons a fucking helicopter in the windshield, and it just explodes. And then a giant ape hand smacks another helicopter down, and King Kong hates helicopters, man. So he's just killing everybody immediately, and they immediately open fire, and that doesn't go well for them, and all the helicopters crash, and thank goodness all of our protagonists lived. And everyone else died, but the protagonists lived.
All of the recognizable actors. Yeah, they're okay.
Yeah, yeah. But they're separated, and they have to get to this rendezvous point, which is when they're going to send helicopters in to rescue them in 3 days. But they have to survive 3 days on an island, which it turns out is full of a whole bunch of giant monsters. So in addition to King Kong, we've got like pterodactyls. We've got giant water bison. There's a giant,
a really cool spidery thing with big long bamboo like legs. I like that monster.
That thing is fucking awesome. So they're like trudging through this bamboo forest, and what they don't realize is that some of like the stalks that they thought were bamboo are actually the very spindly legs of this like gigantic daddy long legs type spider that then shoots down sticky tendrils and starts pulling them up to its mouth. Ooh, that's a good one. that's awesome. I love that thing. Ooh. There's another one I like, which is just sort of an incidental monster, but there's a scene where Toby Kebbell is sitting on a log, and he drops something on the log, and the log gets up. It's like a giant stick insect, but it's like a log insect. And he immediately opens fire on it, and it doesn't kill it, but it looks kind of offended. Like, dude, you set on me. I'm leaving. And then he immediately gets killed by another monster. So the plot is Samuel L. Jackson is furious at Kong. He assumes that Kong is an enemy, something to be killed. It's his new Vietnam, as you mentioned. And he wants to go track down the helicopter that Toby Kebbell was in because that had all of like the heavy munitions so they can kill King Kong. Meanwhile, Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, and Corey Hawkins, they're off on their own.
All right, Corey Hawkins. And, Did you mention Corey Hawkins?
Yeah, he's the Hollow Earth scientist guy. So they're off on their own, and they're trying to get to the rendezvous point. They're trying to get the hell out, and they run across a character who we haven't mentioned yet, but is actually the opening scene in the movie. The opening scene of this movie is World War II, 1944. An American pilot. His plane crashes onto Skull Island and he parachutes down, and a Zero fighter crashes nearby him, and a Japanese soldier also survives, and they immediately try to kill each other. They're just fighting to the death. And then they are interrupted when King Kong shows up, and they go, oh shit. There is a movie that is just that. Just two guys on opposite sides of a war. They don't speak the same language, having to work together to survive in an island of giant monsters with King Kong. That's enough. That you didn't have to do the rest of this. That was amazing pitch.
You've seen Enemy Mine, right?
Yeah, and the movie is based on Hell in the Pacific.
To Enemy Mine.
Which is also basically that setup, but without King Kong. And honestly, I mean, there was an episode of Battlestar Galactica like that. There have been episodes of, like, Star Trek like that. Just, hey, I'm trapped in a place that's very dangerous, and the only person I'm here with is someone who, because of bullshit reasons that humans invent for war, I'm told I'm supposed to hate and want to kill. Yeah. And vice versa. That's enough. That's enough for a movie. That would have been such an awesome movie. Instead, we cut to over three decades later, and they run into him, and now that guy is John C. Reilly, and the Japanese soldier has died off camera. I'm not sure why we needed that.
They could have had, I mean, you already got a dozen characters. What's another one? Just keep him alive. Right? Have him be another regular character in this thing.
He
dies off camera. John C. Reilly has fallen in with the locals who live on Skull Island, who have understood that Kong is the ruler of the island.
Yeah, Kong, it's his island. They're just renting it.
Yeah, you get away from Kong because Kong is a gigantic ape that'll squish you. But he's also like, sort of, they stage it like he's Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now, but he's more like the Dennis Hopper character from Apocalypse Now, where he's a little bit manic and kind of silly. He's kind of a comedic character.
Colonel Kurtz character is not a good guy. Like, John C. Reilly has clearly been there too long, and there's a couple of like good bits where he's talking to some guy, and he's like, I was like, actually, I have no idea if I'm talking right now. Am I actually talking right now? And he's like, yeah, you're saying stuff out loud. He's like, great. Sometimes I don't know.
Yeah, the natives of Skull Island, I don't think they give them a name in this movie, or do they?
I don't think they do. I think they do in later films. I don't think they actually give them a name in this
one. Yeah, in later films, they're called the Iwi, I-W-I. Yeah. And they're still othered.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie, that's still an aspect of King Kong that we just can't get away from, but at least they're treated as like wise and peaceful rather than, you know, aggressive and gross.
It's not actively insulting, even though it is reductive. I mean, that is an improvement. We still have a long conversation to have, but at least it's an improvement. I guess that's a thing, but, he gives them a big speech, and he explains, hey, here's how the island works. And how the island works is this. There's a whole bunch of giant monsters, but the ones you really have to be on the lookout for are called skull crawlers. And there's a cute bit where they ask him, why are they called skull crawlers? And he's like, I don't know. I named them. I'm trying to scare you here. They're scary monsters. Cool.
Yeah.
I want them to sound scary because you should be scared of them. And I'm like, and they're like, oh, yeah, no, sure, it's fine. And skull crawlers are actually based on one of the monsters that was briefly featured in the original King Kong. And they're basically giant snakes with arms. And they're pretty scary.
And they walk around on the arms, but they have no back legs. Like, they just have these two big, weird shouldery leg things.
And the front
kind
of cool their,
looking.
Yeah, and the front of their face kind of looks like a skull. So honestly, not a bad name. Yeah. In fact, if they said, why do they call them skull crawlers? Well, their face looks like a skull and they crawl. What do you want from me? That would have been enough. You didn't have to make a joke. But the thing is that those used to run the island until the giant apes showed up. And the giant apes were like taking care of the island and everything. And then the skull crawlers killed all of them except for Kong. And now Kong is the only ape that is keeping the skull crawler population in check. Yeah. And so we need him, because without him, the Skullcrawlers will kill everything. And there's a giant Skullcrawler that lives in, like, the hollow part of the island that will emerge if Kong is incapacitated. So if Samuel L. Jackson gets his way, they're all going to be killed by this giant Skullcrawler monster.
So, which, boom. By the way, is the plot of several Pokemon movies.
Sure.
Like, if we collect this one magical beast, it'll upset the balance of nature and unleash this other magical beast that's even more destructive.
Right.
And so we can't collect them all, even though the slogan of the whole franchise has got to collect them all.
We've learned a lot today. I'm trying to make sure there aren't any, like, points in the movie. I take a lot of notes for this podcast. Oh, one note. This is way back early in the movie. But Brie Larson's character is named Mason Weaver, and when she shows up, like, on the boat, and she says, "Oh, hi, I'm Mason Weaver." One of the scientists says, "Mason Weaver is a woman?" And she's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Oh my god, is this the last time we ever used this awful fucking trope?" I've lost track of how many shitty fucking, usually in a shitty fucking movie, where there's a character who is a woman, but they have a masculine-sounding name, like a conventionally masculine-sounding name, and they're spoken of by name by a bunch of guys. Like, oh, that guy sounds like a total badass. And then Michelle Rodriguez or someone walks in, and all the guys go, it's a woman?
A girl?
Yeah, like, oh my god, I've learned something today. I'm going to have to check my biases. Like, oh my god, how fucking old is that? How amazingly outdated is that trope? I mean, I know it's set in the 70s, but it wasn't made in the 70s. Come on now. I don't think I've seen it since this movie came out. I really hope that one's over, because it's not a good trope. It's so ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that they are trying to address sexism, but yeah, it's such an old trope that it's boring now. It's not even a good way to address sexism anymore, because it's just a cliche.
At best, it's trite. Like, come on.
Well, and the issue is, sexism isn't a part of this movie.
The
fact that Brie Larson is a woman doesn't play into the story. It doesn't affect how other people address her or communicate to her.
Yeah,
it doesn't affect her professional life whatsoever.
They don't sexualize her. They don't talk down to her at all. It's totally fine, except for this one part where they bring it up.
Yeah.
It's actually really weird. I actually like that they resist the urge to shove any kind of romantic subplot in this. Which I think was a smart play, honestly, because it would have been really tacked on.
I think what's really tacked on, frankly, are the Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston characters.
Yeah, they don't need to be there.
They needed to sort of round out their team, and they're sort of putting together this ragtag group of explorers, which, you know, is cliches and tropes from a lot of old genre films. So they have, you know, the grizzled old soldier, you have the kooky guy they find on the island, who's essentially Ben Gunn from Treasure Island.
Sure.
And then you have like the plucky girl photographer, which is also a bit of a type. And then you have
Brie Larson doesn't play it that way, though, to be fair. She underplays that.
I think that
makes it better.
Well, she doesn't, but on paper, that's kind of the role she's filling.
Granted.
And same with, Tom Hiddleston. He could very well have been this big, barrel-chested, square-jawed man, and Tom Hiddleston doesn't look that way. He looks like sort of a shrimpy British guy, and that's okay, too. But they have nothing to do other than fulfill those very basic archetypal functions. They don't actually have... There's no spin on those characters, and because they don't really drive the plot forward except in terms of action, they're kind of unnecessary to the movie. And it's just heaping in more characters because I think the filmmakers thought we needed them when really we didn't.
I would argue, and I'm not saying this is a good idea, but I would argue that the rationale for that is because the body count in this movie is really high. Like, people die constantly. And after the initial slaughter of all the incidental characters who didn't have any dialogue, I think they still wanted enough characters that they could die throughout the movie, often somewhat unexpectedly, and still have other characters left over to fill the dramatic function that they had. Yeah. So, you know, you kill off John Goodman dies in this kind of unceremoniously in this movie, but we still have other scientist characters to fill that role. We still have other people who are, like, working for Monarch to fill that role. So I think you do want... I think if this movie is only the Marines on Skull Island, it's a different film. It might be a good film, but it's a different film. And I think you want to have characters who represent people who... And I think in Brie Larson's case, conscientious objector to the Vietnam War. And in the case of Tom Hiddleston, someone who has a military background, but also... isn't cool with what's actually happening and showing that, like, we're not, you know.
Yeah.
Here's someone who is capable of handling themselves in a dangerous situation, but is still not going to go full Apocalypse Now on us.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. I understand those are the roles they play, but I feel like we could have gotten that from the other characters that we already had.
I don't disagree. I'm just saying I think they just wanted fodder. And I think they wanted to kill some people in an unexpected way.
Okay, that's fair.
Toby Kebbell dies in an unexpected way. John Goodman dies in an unexpected way. There's a great bit with Shea Whigham. And Shea Whigham, I don't know what his note was on his character. He's just a guy who says weird shit. And somehow Shea Whigham makes it work. I actually really like, there's a bit after Kong has, like, destroyed all the helicopters. And I think it's Jason Mitchell is talking to him. And he's like, what the hell just happened? Oh my god, and Shea Whigham's just like eating out of like a can of chili or something like that, and he's like, how are you eating right now? It's like, oh, I'm hungry. It's like, why aren't you freaking out? Did you just see what happened to us? And he's like, yeah, I mean, you know, there's no tactical precedent for that, so I think we did as well as we could under the circumstances. It's like, that's not the point. How are you on this wavelength? Later on at the end of the movie, when they're like running from all the monsters and everything, Shea Whigham, for no particular reason, like, it doesn't seem like it's, like, the natural ending of his character. It's like, oh, I'm so done with it. I'm gonna go out in a heroic fashion. He decides he's gonna pop the pins off of two grenades, keep them in his hands, and then just stand in the way of the skull crawler and wait until the skull crawler eats him, and then he'll blow up the skull crawler. Huge heroic sacrifice.
Yeah.
And then the skull crawler
but it
just
doesn't go,
flicks
it doesn't
him,
go that well.
It just flicks him with its tail into a mountain. It's so anticlimactic. It doesn't mean
I appreciate moments like that. You know, like, sure. I'm going to do something. I always appreciate moments in movies where a character is going to do something really badass and then they end up looking really ridiculous. I like that kind of undercut because I've had enough badassery. I've seen so many movies with badasses. It's not impressive.
And you can overdo
Show me a badass who messes up.
Yeah, well, and you can overdo that. If that's all you do, it gets tiresome quickly. But and this is actually something I really like about Kong Skull Island, because I think it's really, really good at keeping all of these different pieces in play. There are sequences in the movie that are legitimately awesome to look at. There's an actual eye to cinematic framing in this film that I think a lot of big-budget movies don't even bother with anymore. Like, really just memorable shots. There's a great shot of, like, a big old wide view of the setting sun, and that there's like a haze in the air, and the helicopter's in the foreground, and Godzilla's kind of blurry, and not Godzilla, King Kong is kind of blurry in the background, but you get a good sense of his size, and like, that's an incredible shot. That's a really painterly shot in this should be cheesy blockbuster movie. They put some effort into that, and I think that works, but it's still able to have those moments where they pull the rug out from under us and have the humor, and because they're able to take it seriously when it needs to be and be funny when it needs to be and not confuse those two moments, it's actually a much, like, better, like, more tightly constructed film. It feels like a more complete experience.
Yeah. This was directed by the director is named Jordan Vogt Roberts, and he has only done two films in his career. Before this, he did a film called The Kings of Summer, which I didn't see. It was like he was another one of those.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. He's one of those, one of the many, many examples in Hollywood of a filmmaker who made like a pretty successful indie feature and was immediately scooped up by the Hollywood machine to do like a giant chapter in a major blockbuster series.
Yeah.
That's what happened with Colin Trevorrow. That's what happened with Gareth Edwards. Just take your pick. Indie filmmakers making these blockbusters. This Kong Skull Island was a big hit, and he hasn't made a movie since. I'm not exactly sure why.
He's been attached to other things since, but I think there was a sexual harassment allegation in 2017 from Dana DiArmond against Vogt Roberts. I don't know all the details of it. I think he kissed her or something without her consent or something. Yeah, but yeah,
they were drunk and he kissed her without consent. And yeah, like
I think that derailed him in the public eye, and he hasn't really been able to get a project off the ground since. I don't know, but he has been attached to other projects since. So apparently it hasn't derailed him entirely. I mean, he might just have just a bunch of projects stuck in development hell. I don't know. I don't know the details of the situation, but that's what I've heard. And I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't heard from him as much. Regardless, I mean, this is a striking film. And unlike a lot of independent filmmakers who are then swooped up to these blockbuster films, the movie that he happened to direct actually has a distinctive vibe.
Yeah, it's underneath, kind of under the surface. This does have that sort of Hollywood reek to it, where it feels like it went through maybe a few too many, like one or two too many drafts. Things feel a little bit artificially constructed. It doesn't feel like this is something he brought to the table. Like, he wasn't really passionate about it. But that said, he was able to bring at least something of a stamp to it. And, you know, he was able to get some really interesting actors. And like I said, I think the Samuel L. Jackson character is maybe the most important character in the movie, just because he's carrying what the movie is about.
But I
also agree with you. I don't want a movie just about the soldiers. It's nice to have a counterbalance because it is an anti-war picture, and you need anti-war characters in it as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, we would have the soldiers, and then we can cut back to the scientists. I just think that there's too many of in each group has too many characters.
I think one of the fixes to this would have been to have another character, have the Japanese soldier that John C. Reilly was with, because what better way to illustrate that the people you thought were your enemy don't have to be your enemy than the characters who literally did that? That's part of the plot.
Yeah.
But because that other character is dead, it's not really sold as well as it could be as part of that narrative. And I feel like the movie makes some weird steps like throughout that kind of undermine it. Like there's the whole thing that Samuel L. Jackson is saying as he's like leading his guys, not to the rendezvous point, but to where Chapman, the Toby Kebbell character, was, because that's where A, his soldier is. He wants to save him. Noble. But mostly because that's where all the heavy artillery is, and that's how he's going to kill King Kong.
Yeah.
And we see early in the movie that Toby Kebbell's character has been killed by one of the Skullcrawlers. But the characters don't know that yet. And there's a part where they all reunite, Tom Hiddleston and Samuel Jackson and Brie Larson, everybody. And they say, hey, listen, we got to get to the rendezvous point. Time's a-wasting. And Samuel Jackson's like, no, we have to go rescue my guy because we need to rescue him. And it's like, yeah, but the audience knows he's dead. So that level of sort of justification is undermined because we know this won't go there. If we didn't know he was dead, if you had saved that for some kind of like gross reveal, like, I don't know, like the way they revealed Samuel L. Jackson died in Jurassic Park, that might have sold that better and kept us in a bit more suspense. And I think that was kind of a weird choice, and I don't really think that that really functioned. But if that was the biggest problem with the movie, that's not bad. It's just not especially great, you know?
I like that we know he's dead, though, because that gives a good feeling of futility to their entire endeavor. It just highlights the fact that he can't win in this scenario. There's no way for him to get out in the way he wants to. And I like that. I guess
that could have been sold better, but yeah, fair enough. I do appreciate, there's actually a good line where they're trying to Samuel Jackson has gotten all the heavy artillery, and he's going to set up some explosives to attract King Kong and then kill King Kong. And Tom Hiddleston and Brie Larson are trying to stop him because if you kill Kong, the Skull Crawlers are going to be a bigger problem.
Yeah.
And also, they had a little moment with Kong where they're like, we're cool, right? So they think of him as their buddy.
Yeah, Brie Larson gets to like sort of touch his lip, and yeah, King Kong doesn't hurt them. And
like the Brontosaurus scene, or Patasaurus, I guess, scene. No, the Brachiosaurus scene in Jurassic Park, where it's like, yeah, you can touch him. It's like a big cow. it's a lot like that moment. It's just like we can make some kind of physical contact with this creature, and that's got to be weird for King Kong, you know? Like to just imagine if like you were like alone in your house for a really long time. And then, like, one of the bugs, like, waved to you from a shelf. And you, like, you went to look at the bug. And the bug just put out, like, one of its antennae and, like, touched your nose. And instead of going, I need to do something about these bugs, you're thinking to yourself, I guess we're friends now.
Well, but Kong knew people. Kong knew that there were people on the island. It's not like Kong was unfamiliar with the people he lived with. Imagine
I'm familiar with bugs as well. I just don't understand. I don't really see him.
Imagine
like,
having like
interacting
like,
with them, you know?
Like cats in your stray cats in your neighborhood, and you recognize certain stray cats, and one of them just sort of comes up and rubs against your leg every once in a while in a gesture of friendliness, and then runs off.
I guess I just see. I think that there is some kind of sort of size issue where I think if an animal is too big, we don't make it a pet. You know, it's like it's pretty rare.
Well, it's illegal
to
for
have
a lot of those, but yeah,
exactly. But like maybe a horse that's pretty big, right? Some people might have like a horse. You know, in some cultures, people would have like an elephant, maybe, but that's an exception. Like, but generally speaking, you know, people don't have, you know, a bear as a pet.
Yeah.
That's generally considered unwise. Watch Grizzly Man sometime. But make them smaller. Okay, now we're looking like dogs and cats. Yeah, keep them in the house. Let's be friends with them. And then you get a little smaller, and then all of a sudden they're vermin now, because then they're mice. And some people have pet mice. I had a pet rat when I was a kid. But mostly we think of smaller animals than that as pests.
Mm.
So I feel like to King Kong, the humans in this movie, I suppose the big difference would be that he recognizes that they're constructed physically the same as him. They just have less hair. Like, so yeah. I guess maybe that would be a differential factor. But I guess keep thinking to myself, man, if a cockroach tried to get my attention, I guess if it showed some kind of agency and I was like, not too shocked to like notice, I might be able to be like Joe's apartment on this thing and like become friends, but like it's not necessarily where my mind immediately goes. So anyway,
yeah.
So they confront Samuel L. Jackson and say, hey, listen, you can't kill Kong. You know, you're the one who turned him into an enemy. That's kind of on us. We literally dropped bombs on his island, for Christ's sake. And Brie Larson has a line, and oh, what a line. Stop. The world is bigger than this. And I love Samuel L. Jackson's response, because his response, and I'm quoting here, is, bitch, please. And that's a line that I think only Samuel L. Jackson can really sell. You know, I can't imagine Tom Hiddleston making that line work, you know? He's a good actor, yeah. But no, you need Samuel L. Jackson to sell that line. Nobody swears like Samuel L. Jackson. So he tries to attack Kong, and as soon as it looks like he's got Kong on the ropes and he's about to blow up Kong's head, this giant skull crawler shows up. And Samuel L. Jackson, he's so far gone that even when he sees the skull crawler attacking, his only thought is, okay, but I'm still going to kill Kong. And just before he's about to press this like detonator button, Kong squishes him with his hand.
Yeah.
Which you'd think would have set off the detonator, considering that was just about pressing a button, and that's a big old button press, but
nope,
whatever. I guess Kong got lucky. Yeah. Kong got lucky. That's all I'm going to say. And Kong fights the skull crawler. Our heroes are getting away in a boat that they had made with John C. Reilly, and they try to save Kong at the last minute with big, you know, Gatling guns. And Brie Larson gets knocked off of a mountain into a river, and she's drowning. And Kong, who, again, had a moment with her, reaches into the river and like scoops her out like a bee in your swimming pool. And he's got her in his hands, and obviously, you know, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation is probably not feasible in this scenario, so he's trying to figure out what to do. And then Skullcrawler attacks again, and instead of putting her down, Kong keeps her in his hand and, like, clutches it like a fist and keeps fighting the Skullcrawler, and the Skullcrawler, like, bites down on his hand and almost swallows it, and then Kong, like, pulls out his intestines from the inside, all while Brie Larson is... She's dead.
Mm-hmm.
She died in that hand. There was absolutely no way he didn't accidentally crush her spine or something. I'm willing to go suspension of disbelief, but I know how fragile the human body is. No. I don't believe that she's fine after that.
I've seen enough like action and horror and monster movies that I can accept when people get sort of jostled about in a way that will kill them ordinarily and suspend my disbelief.
I'd be willing to do that,
especially
in this moment. Yeah. Go ahead.
Because it only happens in the one scene in this movie. It's not like people are getting flung about all the time and they always get up. That would be noticeable.
But that's kind of...
I remember one of the more recent superhero flicks. Black Widow.
Yeah. Great example.
Black Widow is not a superpowered character. She's like a super secret spy. Mm-hmm. But there's so many scenes in that movie where she like falls out of planes or gets in car wrecks where the car just sort of cartwheels and she just sort of like gets out and brushes herself off.
Yeah.
You start to notice after a while that she's not injured. It's like, okay, something weird is happening.
Yeah.
Something like this, it doesn't bother me. It happened once, I'm okay.
Well, it's not that it happened. If it had happened, if she had just fallen off a really tall thing and got up and she was fine, which happens to many characters, the characters who fall out of helicopters or get, like, dropped by a giant spider, like, 30 feet and land on their back on uneven terrain in the jungle and get up going, whew, that was close. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to let it go. I'm willing to accept that this is a little bit of a cartoon. But it's an extended sequence where we see his clenched fist, which we know she's in, and him, like, attacking a monster with it. It's because it's not brief. It's only one scene, but it's not brief. And so I can't suspend my disbelief for that. I find that very distracting. Uh-huh. But I see your point. But anyway, Kong defeats the Skullcrawler. Our heroes decide. There's a weird scene because they say, like, the word will get out about this. It always does. But Brie Larson, who's been photographing everything, says, yes, but not from us. And I'm like, yeah, no. Like, what are you going to do? They're going
to... I don't...
A bunch of Marines came out of this. They're going to tell their government. You know? Like, when the helicopter comes to rescue them, Kong is right there. The helicopter pilot saw him. He's literally just to the left, and he's roaring. He's not hiding. So... Right. That means nothing. And indeed, the after the credits sequence is Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston in a room with a two-way mirror. And then Corey Hawkins comes in and says, hey, yeah, we're enlisting you in Monarch now because you know about giant monsters. And here's a little demo reel of some monsters we're going to do in the next Godzilla movie. Here's a cave painting of Godzilla, cave painting of Mothra, cave painting of Rodan, and the cave painting of King Ghidorah. Buy your tickets now.
Yeah, yeah. That was my least favorite part of the movie. It's just, okay, yeah. And there's going to be Kong. Yeah, I mean, I know, but...
Well, and especially because those characters don't come back. So
yeah.
It's not
well,
like...
Those
it's not like
characters
the old version.
Don't come back.
Yeah, like Corey Hawkins' character comes back, but not those guys. So enlisting them in that post-credit sequence is just nothing.
It's nothing, and because this movie's set in the 70s, it's like, okay... There's this revelation. We know that these other monsters exist. But does that mean, you know, the Godzilla movie we saw already took place in the present? We're 40 years removed. Mm-hmm. Does that mean we know about these monsters and we're going to do nothing about them for 40 years? That's actually also kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah, so, like, and if anything did happen, it would have to be... It has to have happened, like, in a way with, like, plausible deniability off the book. So nothing too bad can happen.
Yeah.
That doesn't help either.
Nothing too bad can happen. And also, at this point in film history, this was 2017, this movie came out, and by then we are many years deep into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The idea of interconnecting all of your films, A, it was already tiresome because it only has one gimmick. They all meet in one movie. And secondly, it was just a pathetic chase of trends. I understand Godzilla predated the Marvel Cinematic Universe by several decades, but Warner Brothers was doing it just then. It felt like such a cheap trick that they're just trying to play on audiences.
Well, I think one of the problems with the cinematic universe as Marvel developed it.
Uh-huh.
And initially this was neat, but they stopped coming up with a fun way to do it. Was so much of it was based on post-credit sequences that teased a connection to another movie or characters meeting other characters. And then eventually Marvel would actually do more actual like team up movies. Like here's a movie with, Iron Man and Spider-Man.
Two characters.
Yeah. And here's Thor and the Hulk. Isn't that kind of fun? And actually, yeah, because then you're actually doing something. But a lot of the time it's basically just, here's Benicio Del Toro. Yeah. He'll be in the next movie. Cool, thanks. Okay, yeah, here's Patton Oswalt is a space gnome. And also Harry Styles is here playing a character whose superpower would get him in trouble immediately in today's climate, so I don't even know where we're going with that.
It's all over. We're not going to see that character again.
Probably not, but my point is this. When you're doing it all in the post-credit sequences, it's very clearly just a commercial at that point. And honestly, we've talked about this a lot, how frustrating it was to see a movie. And it's a whole movie, and sometimes a very good one. You know, we waited so long to see this superhero movie or this franchise movie or whatever. And instead of leaving the theater talking about all the stuff that happened in the movie we just saw, we're encouraged to leave the theater talking about, ooh, what's going to happen in the sequel? And it's like, that's so... There's a few times when, I mean, obviously the first time when they did it at the end of Iron Man, it was kind of a big deal because no one had ever done it before. Fair enough. But very quickly, like, and there's a couple of them that are neat, but mostly it's pretty, it's not a great gimmick. And in this case, other than saying, hey, yeah, it's going to be another Godzilla movie and there'll be more monsters in it, what did we think they were gonna do? Like, if there's gonna be another one, they'll probably be more monsters, right? I mean, I guess it's cool to know that we're gonna have like King Ghidorah and Mothra and shit, but like, I'm not surprised. What they could have done, like, okay, like imagine if it was actually surprising, it might have been cool. Like, at the end, they're in the interrogation room or whatever, and Corey Hawkins says, "Yeah, no, we need you to join Monarch." Turns out there's a lot more monsters, and it's like a picture of the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. And then I'd be like, oh shit, I did not see that coming. That's a whole new crossover that we're going to do. That's neat, you know?
if they had done that, like, I would have been excited just because that would have been unexpected.
Right? It's like, unexpected.
Oh crap, yeah.
We just want something genuinely unexpected.
Not that I have like a deep desire to see King Kong fight the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, but you would have kept me off balance a little
bit. Can you imagine just seeing King Kong just take bites out of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, just gradually eating more and more of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man? Because here's the thing. That sounds like it's an easy, like, oh, he's just going to eat the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, right? Have you ever eaten that much marshmallow? Because it expands in your stomach.
Oh, yeah, it makes you sick.
Like, yeah, so, like, if you eat... try to eat, like, more than, like, 5 marshmallows and just see how quickly you get sick. Because the marshmallow expands in your stomach and you can't eat that much. Kong is not going to be able to eat a whole Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. He's going to have to throw up the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and then the thrown up Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is going to, like, rejoin the Stay Puft... It's not going to be an easy fight. It's going to be really tricky. And I really want to see that movie now.
Oh, God, I'd like to see Kong eating the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, eats him to death, and then, like, starts staggering around New York feeling a little sick, and then just lurches over and fills the East River. Be just, like, revolting and amazing, like, and that's the climax of the movie.
Yeah. No, that's the post-credit sequence.
just Kong barfing everywhere.
And there's one more bit. There's just real fast, just so we covered everything. The last scene before the actual credits is John C. Reilly goes home and, like, sees his wife for the first time in 30 years and meets his son for the very first time. And his son is played by the same actor who played the young John C. Reilly at the beginning, and that's kind of cute.
I didn't notice that. Okay.
And then earlier in the movie, he had asked, like, hey, what have I missed? And they talk about, they put a man on the moon. He's like, oh, really? What, did we just leave him there? Like, a cute little bit. Yeah. But he also asked if the Cubs had been to the World Series yet. No. I mean, they had early on in like the 1910s or something like that, but by this, like, from 1940s to 1970s, no. And then there's a weird bit that shows him watching a Cubs game on a TV, drinking a beer, back home.
Finally back home, yeah.
Got the creature comforts. And then we cut to this Cubs game, and some announcer's saying, like, oh my God, they did it! The dream has come true! Kind of implying that the Cubs, like, made it to the World Series or won the World Series. No!
No,
we have Wikipedia now. We know that they didn't. You don't even have to know anything about sports to know that. You can look that up.
Well, and they wouldn't win until, when was it? It was like 20... It was just recently. It was before the movie came out. Just before the movie came out. So, like, I think that's what they were alluding to, that the Chicago Cubs finally just won.
Well, then maybe they should have shown, like, John C. Reilly, like, super old with, like, a really old poofy beard.
Oh, like... Like, see, hang on.
His kids are playing like a Nintendo Switch. His grandkids are playing a Nintendo Switch in the background or something. Like, but yeah, that's Kong Skull. Okay, you know
World Series titles 1907, 1908, and then 2016. It was that long before the Cubs won the World Series again.
Yeah.
I just looked it up.
No, fair enough. But yeah, no, this is a good movie. I would dare say that this is easily. I mean, I admit I haven't seen King Kong Lives, but man, this is maybe. Like, this is a really good King Kong movie.
It's a good King Kong movie. Yeah. I feel like until I've said this before, I think that the MonsterVerse wasn't really cracked until Adam Wingard got a hold of it.
And ironically, they wanted him to direct this movie, and I think they even enlisted him for a bit, and it didn't work out or something.
Mm. I think Jordan Roberts does a fine job on this movie. Mm. But yeah, I feel like even. Adam Wingard didn't, make the MonsterVerse, like, more meaningful. He didn't bring a lot of ideas or themes into this.
In fact, he
deliberately made them, like, shallower and simpler, and I think that's what makes them exciting. But at the same time, they are just shallow movies, and I feel like Jordan Vogt Roberts actually has made what might be, like... just like the richest, best film in this series.
Actually seen them all, I feel comfortable saying that's basically true. We're going to rewatch some of these movies we haven't seen in a while, and maybe I'll come around.
Yeah, maybe King of the Monsters is better than I remember. I remember not liking it very much, but we'll see.
I want to correct myself. Adam Wingard was apparently hand-selected by Peter Jackson to do Skull Island back when it was going to be a sequel to Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Oh, okay.
And then the movie switched studios because I think that Peter Jackson film was like a Universal movie, and these are from Warner Brothers. And it changed hands a bunch of times, and then eventually Jordan Vogt Roberts ended up on the project. Adam Wingard eventually got it back, and got to do a bunch of weird King Kong shit. But yeah, so that is it for Kong Skull Island. I think of the films that I've rewatched for this so far, definitely the one that I like more than I remember. Like, I guess I
liked it better this time. Definitely liked it better this time than when I first saw it.
I was a little surprised to discover that the Roland Emmerich Godzilla was more watchable than I remembered, but it wasn't very good. And this one is actually very good. A few nitpicks aside, like, I'm actually a really big fan of it, so I'm really glad we revisited it. Next time on Thank Godzilla It's Friday, we were gonna do a short film, but we talked it over and we realized that it doesn't really connect as closely as the other films, and if we open that can of worms, we have to do a billion short films, and we already kind of danced on the knife edge with Bambi versus Godzilla, so we're just going to let that go.
Bambi meets Godzilla,
In an effort to keep this streamlined and not open too many more avenues. That's just going to keep this going for literally ever. So next time on Thank Godzilla It's Friday, we're going to go from, we went from the MonsterVerse to the Reiwa era, back to the MonsterVerse, and now we're going to go to, I guess it's the Netflix-verse, because it's the first Godzilla anime feature film, Godzilla Planet of the Monsters.
Yeah, it's an anime film. It was released by Netflix. Technically, it's part of the Reiwa era, just because of the era in which it was made, but
sure.
The three animated films are part of a connected trilogy, and they are not connected to any of the other Godzilla movies. So there's three animated films that are their own thing.
And these are the last movies that we're covering, or at least planning to cover for this series, that I've never seen. Mm-hmm. I completely just didn't see them the first time they were out. So I am looking forward to exploring this corner of the Godzilla-verse. And I hope it's really cool, and we'll find out. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. If you want to listen to episodes of Thank Godzilla It's Friday a week early, you head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You can listen to our episodes ad-free, and you can listen to TGIF 1 week early every single week. We also have a whole bunch of exclusive shows over there, including shows dedicated to every film ever nominated for Best Picture, every episode of Star Trek ever made. We did a commentary track for Highlander 2, The Quickening recently, and we're gearing up to do one for Nuki, which is considered one of the worst movies ever made, and I've actually never seen it, so this should be a trip.
Oh, you're in for a treat.
I've heard the legends, but I've actually never taken this ride, so let's batten down the hatches and make it so. And a whole bunch of other stuff besides. So thank you to all of our patrons. Without you, we can't do what we do. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts for supporting the show financially. We know it's a hard time, and it means the world to us. If you want to support the show but you can't afford to be part of the Patreon, please, if you haven't subscribe. And if you haven't left us a review, it would mean the world to us if you left a review. Star rating, a sentence even. Just let the world know, we think these guys are okay, I guess. And then that actually helps us find new audiences as the algorithm notices that people care enough to interact. So
yeah.
That would be awesome. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, you can always email us. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
thought you were going to forget the last one. Okay.
No, I got a little bit of a hiccup there.
A little winded. We're getting old. Cool beans. And that's it. So we'll see you next time for the anime Godzilla. And until then, roar, and other things as well.